Welcome back to the Maritime History Program on Boat Radio. As always, I'm your host, Brandon Huebner, this week bringing you Episode 12, Minoan Thalassocracy. Today, we'll take a look at the maritime evidence connected to the Minoan civilization and try to find the line between reality and some of the supposition that's taken place in regard to the Minoans. This may prove difficult at times. The Minoans are a people still shrouded in a high degree of mystery, but we will see what archaeology and all that can reveal to us about the past. At the outset here, I do have to say that the Minoan civilization has been, thus far in our narrative, the biggest surprise to me personally. For some reason, in my mind, the Minoans had always occupied a place of pseudo-familiarity, especially in comparison to the Harappan people that we've looked at last time. The name Minoan is familiar, as are the myths associated with them and King Minos. These are among some of the most recognizable myths in all of Greek mythology. I may have been a bit off base in my admittedly ignorant assumptions about the Minoans, and my ignorance about the Harappan civilization is also sadly common in the West, though that's no excuse. As I hope to convey through this episode, for all the name recognition that the Minoans may possess today, or previously had in my own head anyway, we actually don't have many specific details about the culture and nuances of the Minoan people or their civilization. Concerning the name recognition aspect, the name Minos tends to evoke images of myth and legend, at least if you're anything like me, it does. The earliest of true civilizations to occupy the island of Crete has come to be known as the Minoan civilization after this mythical King Minos. In the Odyssey, the hero Odysseus is asked to tell of his lineage, and the first lines of his responding story went like this. There is a country, Crete, in the midst of the wine-dark sea, a fair land and a rich, begirt with water. The people there are many, innumerable indeed, and they have 90 cities. Their speech is mixed, one language joins another. Here are Achaeans, here brave native Cretans, here Sidonians, crested Dorians, and noble Pelasgians. Of all their towns, the capital is Knossos, where Minos became king when 9 years old. Minos, the friends of mighty Zeus and father of my father, bold Deucalion. So in this passage from the Odyssey, there is an allusion, which is more explicitly stated in other places throughout Greek mythology, the allusion that King Minos was a son of Zeus himself. The famous stories affiliated with Minos, for example the Minotaur and the labyrinth that Minos had built beneath his palace at Knossos, in addition to his supposed divine lineage, these myths should serve as somewhat of a red flag that Minos may not have been an actual king. When it comes to Minos, the debate tends to be about whether mythical figures like him were completely real, completely mythical, or somewhere in the middle ground area. The typical middle ground argument is that these mythical figures were rooted in history, but that elaborate mythology gradually evolved to the point that any distinct line between fact and fiction has been smudged beyond repair. As we delve into the specifics of what we now know as the Minoan civilization, I'd like to go ahead and frame our discussion in terms similar to the debate that surrounds King Minos as a historical figure. The best person to open with one view of the Minoans in history is none other than Thucydides. Thucydides was a Greek historian, and in describing some of the background history to his treatment of the Peloponnesian War, he describes Minos and his realm as an empire, or a thalassocracy, which is a word that I'll define here in just a minute. Thucydides, in his writings, said this: Minos, according to tradition, was the first person to organize a navy. He controlled the greater part of what is now called the Hellenic or Aegean Sea. He ruled over the Cyclades, and it is reasonable to suppose that he did his best to put down piracy in order to secure his own revenues. Thucydides then describes a Minoan empire that exercised direct control over a large part of the Aegean, a view that proponents of our first interpretation share. This theory posits an actual historical Minoan thalassocracy that existed in historical fact, and that saw Minos rule an empire which covered a majority of the Aegean Sea, all centrally from his palace at Knossos on Crete. The second camp comprises a more recent trend in historical interpretation. This is made up of those who believe that the numerous islands of the Aegean were politically autonomous from Crete, and that Minoan influence in the greater Aegean was merely economic and cultural, even if there may have been a small measure of diplomatic control emanating from Knossos. What I hope to do in the balance of today's episode is to not necessarily take one side or the other, although my leanings will probably become apparent. Rather, I will try to give a good overview of the main arguments from each camp, along with the historical framework within which these arguments are framed, then leaving you to draw your own conclusions about which camp has a stronger position. Before we start to look at the two sides of the debate, though, let's go ahead and briefly define the weird word that I have thrown out a few times now, the word thalassocracy. This is a word of Greek origin. It's rooted in two specific Greek words. The first is thalassa, meaning sea, and the second is kratein, which is a verb meaning to rule. The two words together then make up the word thalassocracy, which literally means to rule the sea or rule of the sea. This word thalassocracy is now used as a descriptive label for states that are primarily maritime empires, like the Phoenician civilization, for instance, which I do promise that we will get to cover in due time. So now that we've seen the basic alternative arguments and seen just what exactly a thalassocracy is, let's get into the history of the Minoan people of Crete and beyond. The origin of these people is shrouded in the mists of prehistory. Archaeological work has shown evidence of settlement on Mediterranean islands stretching back into Neolithic times, and this should really come as no surprise to us. The geographic reality of the Mediterranean is that of many small but scattered islands that are oftentimes close enough to one another that they can be seen with the naked eye. Keeping this in consideration, it doesn't take much extra imagination to be able to picture the earliest of mankind venturing onto the water in a log boat, or even simply floating on some appropriate vessel and paddling his way toward an in-view piece of land, ultimately resulting in the prehistoric presence of man on numerous Mediterranean outposts. The island of Crete became the site of comparatively concentrated settlement even back in Neolithic times, this likely due to its location off the western coast of Anatolia and at the southern end of the Aegean Sea and the Cyclades. That same location, though, can also be seen as a bit less accessible than many of the smaller islands of the Cyclades or the island of Cyprus, This is a point made by Fernand Braudel in his brilliantly written history, Memory and the Mediterranean. It's a little bit outside our scope of focus to look at the Neolithic origins of the Minoans, but in this book, Braudel paints an image of a burgeoning civilization in the Aegean, even before the Bronze Age. He refers to it as a quasi-Aegean civilization, consisting of the Cyclades, the mythical yet historically provable city of Troy, Crete, and the Hellespont. This civilization, claims Braudel, was, quote, dramatically snuffed out by the Indo-European invasions around the 24th century BCE, which saw the ancestors of the Mycenaeans in Greece and the Hittites and Lowites of Anatolia overrun the quasi-Aegean civilization and effectively erase the early economic and cultural levels they had attained. According to Braudel, it was Crete alone that survived this downfall and remained intact enough to have an edge once the Bronze Age began. The long and short of any human Paleolithic activity on Crete for us is that there was some. Since Crete is an island, we know that a fair amount of activity there and any trade or commerce that took place with other civilizations had to have done so via a water route at some point. The Bronze Age in Crete is pinpointed as starting somewhere around 2700 to 2600 BCE, but the period wherein the Minoans began building the imposing palaces, for which they are now remembered, places like Phaistos and Knossos, this palace building period didn't begin until at least 1900 BCE. As I have said here, though, for centuries before the Minoans began constructing their palaces, they were constantly traversing the Mediterranean in boats. Surprisingly, and a bit unfortunately, for all that activity, we have yet to find a shipwreck or even a visual depiction of a boat from early Bronze Age Minoan Crete. What we do have, however, are a few clay ship models, two specifically. One came from Palaikostro, a village on the eastern end of Crete, and the other came from Moklos, a small island that sits off the coast of Crete within the confines of the Gulf of Mirabello. Both of these boat models are roughly dated to the mid to late 2000s BCE, so they represent Minoan boats prior to the palatial period. The Palaikostro model is fairly unique as far as the shape goes, especially in comparison to the early boats of the other cultures that we've looked at so far in our program. One end of this model has a sharp raised point to it, while the other end has a flat step-like projection sticking off near the bottom of the boat. It's been surmised that the tall pointed end was the stern, while the flat projecting piece has been called a forefoot and has been interpreted as either being useful for beaching the boat or for use as a step upon re-entering once the boat has shoved off from shore. Either way, the profile of the boat model bears a distinctly fish-like shape, perhaps the very visual effect that the Minoan creator had envisioned. The Moklos boat model also has relatively high ends, although this model is symmetrical, similar in that fact to some of the boats that we saw from Mesopotamia and Harappa. In any event, both of these models seem to be representations of small boats that wouldn't have been used for long-distance transport on the Mediterranean. They were almost assuredly used for local transport and travel among the islands of the Cyclades, or in and around Crete. The earliest iconic depictions of boats or ships from this time period are slightly younger than the Minoan boat models, although again, precise dating is rather difficult. These depictions aren't strictly tied to the Minoan civilization specifically, and the best example was actually discovered on the small island of Syros in the Cyclades. Similar examples have been found on the Greek mainland and even in Anatolia, so although the ships depicted may not have been used by the Minoans, they just as well could have been, and they were at least used by peoples that had close association with Crete during the early Bronze Age. The objects themselves are commonly called frying pans for their resemblance to our modern idea of a frying pan, but we actually don't know what these ceramic objects were originally used for. They've commonly been found in graves, and their high levels of decoration and imagery suggest that they were items possessed by the wealthier class. Thankfully for us, an image or scene that was commonly depicted on these frying pan disc things is that of a ship on the water. 13 separate depictions of ships have been found on these pans, and by and large, they all depict similar styles of water vessel, a boat or ship with a horizontal hull with one end sharply raised, and the other either not raised at all, or if it is raised, only slightly so. Generally, then, they seem to resemble the boat model found at Palaeocastro. I don't believe I mentioned this earlier, but the shape and the single extreme raised end in these depictions would suggest boats of a wood planked construction, though they could also possibly represent longboats with decorative fittings. The frying pan depictions also contain short, angular lines above and below the hull, generally accepted as representing oars or paddles, though they are very unlikely to be to scale, and thus unlikely to be representative of the number of paddles or the size of the ship itself. I will post an image of a frying pan ship depiction on the website. This one shows how the Cycladic artists would depict waves as being spirals that surround the ship, which is an effect that results in a piece of striking beauty. The boat models and the frying pan boat depictions together give us a decent picture of the fact that the pre-palatial Minoans were quite busy on the waters of the Mediterranean. It makes sense that a concentration of Minoan artifacts would be found close to Crete, and north of Crete in the Cyclades, since the sailing between those islands would have been easier than venturing out south or east from Crete. As the clocks in our narrative shifted past 2000 BCE, Minoan Crete seems to have started expanding rapidly. It probably helped them, as we mentioned earlier, that they survived relatively unscathed during the Aegean upheaval of the early Bronze Age. One theory to explain the rapid expansion on Crete at the turn of the 20th century BCE focuses on the idea that there could have been an influx of migrants from the coast of the Levant, as it was around the same time that Lugal Zaghezi, the Mesopotamian ruler of the 3rd dynasty of Ur, opened the way to, quote, the upper sea of the setting sun. Admittedly, though, this theory has taken some heat in recent years, and it may be invalid. Regardless, though, of what spurred the growth in Minoan Crete, the Minoans built off of their pre-existing culture there, and while Minoan seals show us continued evidence of sailing and maritime activity in the early 2nd millennium BCE, it is evidence from other locations in the ancient world that gives us a closer glimpse at just how far Minoan culture had begun to extend. The dawn of the 20th century BCE in Crete is seen as the beginning of the palatial period, with the neo-palatial period following at the dawn of the 17th century BCE. Essentially, then, the 20th century saw Minoan Crete visibly expand their reach and culture. They'd always had some measure of contact in and around the Mediterranean, but the proto-palatial period shows signs of increasing wealth on Crete, while we simultaneously see signs of their artistic culture being spread as far away as Egypt, but more frequently so to the Levant coast and Anatolia. For instance, a hallmark of Minoan Crete's culture is the exquisite pottery that was made on Crete. One such example, dated to around 1850 BCE, was discovered in the tomb of a man who is thought to have been a prince at Byblos, a city on the Levantine coast, the very Byblos that later became the center of the Phoenician Empire. There is one specific item from this period that is perhaps the perfect microcosm of my point. This is something called the Todd Treasure, a treasure that is currently divided between the Egyptian Museum and the Louvre. I briefly alluded to this treasure back in episode 8, Middle Kingdom Mariners, although I don't think I referred to the treasure by name in that episode. Anyway, the treasure was unearthed in Egypt, where it was buried in the foundation sand beneath the floor of the temple of Senusret I. This treasure was contained in four copper chests, inscribed with the name of Senusret's son, Amenemhat II, a 12th dynasty pharaoh of Egypt. This father-son pair of Egyptian kings ruled over a span of years between 1934 and 1890 BCE. Thus, we can pretty safely assume that the Todd treasure must have arrived in Egypt and been buried at some point before or during the life of one of these two pharaohs. This would then date the treasure to the early 2nd millennium BCE, the very time that Minoan Crete was beginning to expand its influence. This is good evidence in and of itself, but I bring up the treasure here because the content of the treasure chests really illuminates the interwoven nature of the Bronze Age world. I've taken the following description of the treasure from the Louvre's page, where you can see some fine images of the treasure itself. The copper chests were found to contain lapis lazuli, silver ingots, chains, and 153 vases, along with some gold items. These pieces of silver and gold ware were clearly not Egyptian, and were different from anything found before. It was possible to identify the lapis lazuli pieces, however. The silver seals came from an area stretching from Anatolia to the eastern borders of Iran, and were produced throughout the 3rd and into the early 2nd millenniums. The beads and amulets mostly came from Mesopotamia and were made in the latter half of the 3rd millennium. Most of the fragments were too small to be reused. The treasure was a gift to the god Montu, sacrificed forever and intended to remain buried. The origin of the silver cups is an ongoing mystery. They look like ceramics from the Cretan Minoan civilization, which may have imitated metal forms never found outside Todd. Metal was indeed melted down with every generation to meet new tastes and requirements. The Egyptian soil may have preserved metal models that were destroyed elsewhere. Some archaeologists have suggested the mining region of Anatolia or northern Syria, an area of magnificent craftsmanship where fine tableware held an important place in commercial and diplomatic exchanges during the 2nd millennium, on the evidence of archives found in the Palace of Mari. Craftsmen might copy foreign styles, such as that of Minoan art. If the treasure was gathered in northern Syria, it could be a reflection of several styles. Indeed, Egypt's relations with the Levantine coast, especially Byblos, were intense during this period. Essentially, then, the Todd treasure is the perfect picture of how different cultures converged at different places throughout the ancient world, especially here at the turn of the second millennium. Buried in a palace in Egypt, we find goods from Mesopotamia, Syria, Anatolia, and possibly even Minoan Crete. There's enough evidence for Minoan goods and trade throughout the ancient world, continuing later into the second millennium BCE, that I could never hope to cover it all here. Some have raised doubt about whether Crete was even capable of sailing to Egypt or Syria at this point in their history. However, the presence of intercultural trade would suggest that they were at least capable, and in all likelihood that they did so more frequently than many assumed them to have done. In the Odyssey, for instance, we see a description of the Mediterranean winds that made travel between Crete and Egypt a fairly easy affair. Odysseus, on arriving home in Ithaca, disguised as a Cretan merchant, was described by Homer as saying, quote, "My heart impelled me to make a voyage to Egypt with gallant comrades and with ships well fitted. 9 ships I fitted, and my force was soon gathered. For 6 days afterwards my trusty comrades feasted. Embarking on the 7th, we sailed from lowland Crete, the north wind fresh and fair, and moved off easily as if downstream. No ship met harm, but safe and sound we sat, while wind and helmsman kept us steady. In 5 days we arrived at Egypt's flowing stream, and in the Egyptian river I anchored my curved ships." As Odysseus apparently knew, and as the Minoan Cretans would also have been aware, the Mediterranean wind makes the southward journey from Crete to Egypt a simple affair for the knowledgeable sailor. The important point in all of this, though, is that as Minoan culture expanded, so did their trade contacts. We will soon see that their commercial interests would be important to their survival as a society. This point gets us back to our earlier discussion of whether Minoan Crete possessed a thalassocracy or not. There is evidence of their cultural reach all across the Aegean. From their stately palaces on Crete to the similar palaces in the Cyclades and Minoan trading outposts in the Levant and Anatolia, we know that Crete had a far-reaching presence. Further, the far-flung places to which their pottery, artwork, and other wares reached tells us that they must have been quite active on the Mediterranean. The problem comes in the fact that we don't have any physical shipwrecks or remains of Minoan vessels themselves to know whether any of their activity was of a military nature, nor do we have any evidence to give us an idea about how tight their control was of Cretan-style palaces outside Crete itself. Those who back the thalassocracy theory rightly claim that any culture with a commercial network as wide as that of Minoan Crete would have had to focus on managing the security of that network. And in this point, I tend to agree with them. We won't get into it fully today, but pirates have always been attracted to material wealth, something that Crete possessed in decent measure. At the end of the day, it's highly likely that the Minoans had to deal with piracy on some level. Again, the problem is that we don't know much about it based on archaeological evidence uncovered to this point in history. Beyond the defense of their trade network, proponents of the thalassocracy theory also claim that the existence of palaces around the Aegean is a sign that Crete exercised direct political control over an empire of the sea. And at first glance, it may seem like they have a point here. After all, isn't one sign of an empire that there is a consistent style that would indicate cultural unity throughout the empire? An empire like Rome, for instance, or many of the others that probably spring to mind. This question presents a somewhat more difficult puzzle, but again, there's not yet enough evidence to weigh in presumption of a Minoan empire of the sea. Yes, there were palaces after the style of Knossos on Crete. But does that necessarily mean that Crete also exercised control over these palaces? I personally think that a Cretan thalassocracy doesn't quite add up on the basis of our current evidence. And I think that their influence was certainly artistic and cultural, but that these palaces could easily have been imitations wrought by a close relation culturally and geographically. Beyond that, though, I don't think we have enough evidence to support a view of Minoan Empire centered on military control. There is an interesting, rather recent theory that Thucydides' characterization of King Minos as a naval leader wasn't historically accurate, that it was instead an exaggeration made by Thucydides in order to bolster and reflect his fellow Athenians' concerns about piracy, trade, and other similar contemporary issues to the 5th century Athenians. Athens at this time period is a place that could legitimately look to Crete for inspiration, so this theory would make some sense. It is all a bit messy trying to figure out what motivated historians of Thucydides' era, or historians of any era, when they write about cultures that are over 1,000 years removed from their own time. Lots of personal and political and theoretical ideas creep in there that may skew the history of the past a bit, but try we must to figure out what all was going on. In the end, perhaps we could call Minoan Crete a cultural empire, if such a thing exists, but this idea is perhaps a bit too abstract to hold much water. Anyway, as the clock wound forward through the second millennium, Minoan Crete continued to trade with the cultures and people of the Near East. My personal favorite item of Minoan origin is the intricately decorated pottery that has been discovered in numerous locations around the Mediterranean and Near East. This style of pottery decoration happened after what has been called the Great Earthquake, an event that devastated some of the early Minoan palaces in the years around 1700 BCE. The palaces were rebuilt, and trade continued much as it had done before. To a degree, the rebuilding efforts corresponded with a revitalization in trade, and it was during this period that the famous Minoan decorated pottery became ubiquitous. There is one specific potted vase that I'll discuss here in a moment, but it does bear mention that Crete's strong commercial ties with other civilizations around the area probably went a long way toward helping Crete rebuild from the earthquake in the way that it did. Getting to the pottery, though, I will also post some pictures of this pottery, especially the ones that I find particularly fascinating. And you can find the relevant origin info and current whereabouts of this pottery if you're interested. This one specific vase found at Kalana on the island of Aegina bears images of ships that are related to the point at hand. The vase is dated to a period between 1750 to 1650 BCE, so it could have been made either before or after the earthquake. It's a little hard to pinpoint. Either way, the ships depicted on the vase bear a striking resemblance to ships that were depicted on Egyptian artwork from a similar time period, something that's not altogether surprising if we keep in mind the connections that we have been repeatedly drawing between these two civilizations in our talk today. The only major difference from our perspective is that Egypt gave us physical ship remains to examine and to learn from, while thus far in history, Minoan Crete hasn't been kind enough to yield us such remains. Now, there are so many pictorial remains related to Minoan maritime history that I could go through them in a dull, list-like fashion for hours, but I'll spare you the, well, Pleasure may not be the right word there, but I will spare you nonetheless. The most fascinatingly detailed and enlightening of Minoan maritime artifacts is one that I'm going to leave for next week, but I'll at least tell you what it is here today to whet your appetite. This artifact is none other than a set of wall paintings found in the town of Akrotiri on the Cycladic island of Thera, about 70 miles north of Crete. The wall paintings are marvelous, and they tell us a lot about Minoan maritime history, so I plan to discuss them in depth. The island of Thera, though, is important for another reason that I also plan to build our next episode around. The dates aren't agreed upon by all scholars, not surprising again. Some say that it happened in 1628 BCE, some place it nearer to 1500. In the end, though, this island of Thera was the site of a massive volcanic explosion that essentially destroyed the island and wrought a fair amount of damage to Crete and some of the other Cycladic islands. Minoan power had been gradually waning prior to the Thera eruption, and perhaps due in part to the effects of this explosion, Minoan power seems to have drastically declined in the same period. So, for the bulk of our talk next week, I'm going to look at the eruption, what we know about it, and then I'm going to indulge my curiosity a bit and explore the possibility that the Thera eruption may have been the real-life event which formed the basis for the famous legend of Atlantis, most well associated with Plato's reference to a great island that was home to a powerful civilization that vanished under the sea in a day and a night. This theory connecting the Thera eruption and Atlantis is by no means new, but I personally hadn't read too much about it until recently. I've gradually become more interested in the possible roots of mythology in the human mind, and really it's just an intriguing topic to explore. I hope you'll agree, and I hope that you won't mind taking a bit of a sidetrack to look at this. It does connect to maritime history, though, so I don't think it will be too far off topic. As for today, though, that wraps up the material that I have prepared. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you like what you've heard today, visit the program page on boatradio.net. There you can find a link to my main website where I have supplementary maps, images, source lists, and other beneficial supplementary materials. The website also has info about how you can help support the continued production of this free and independent program. Plus, you can find links to connect with us on social media for other news and interesting info about maritime archaeology and history. Check back next week and every week thereafter as we progress through the stories of maritime history together. Until next time, fair winds and following seas. Thanks for listening to the Maritime History Program.